Good morning. So this week, as we begin the book of Exodus with our Torah reading Shemot, we are called to reflect on a great paradox of Torah. Moses, who is chosen to deliver the word of God to the people, describes himself as unable to speak. So this is a good time to wonder about the relationship of speech and silence in Jewish practice and in Buddhist meditation practice. On the one hand, according to Torah, speech brought all of creation into existence. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God spoke the world into existence. On the other hand, we have the Midrash about what was actually spoken and heard at Revelation at Mount Sinai. In this Midrash, we learn it was not the full Torah. It was not the full Ten Commandments. It was not even the first commandment. I am Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, who brought you out of Mitzrayim. And not even just the first word of the first commandment, Anoki, but just the first letter of the first word, Aleph, which is silent. This midrash invites us to pay attention to the silence that is an essential part of Torah, a way of experiencing Torah that is beyond words. It's an invitation into the experience of standing at Sinai, even as we're sitting here right now, studying Torah. We recognize that the same revelation is accessible right now in this moment, because the words of Torah are a gateway, a portal into direct experiencing of the divine presence in each moment. In the Zen tradition, there's also an understanding of the inadequacy of words and the danger of getting trapped in words, of mistaking the word for the experience itself. We are warned, don't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. Or, one of my favorites, open your mouth and you're wrong. Yet, language is an essential guide to Zen practice. The koan famously teaches by confusing us, using words to teach us about the inadequacy of words, forcing us to see the limits of logical thinking in understanding the great truths of existence. These truths, like the cause of suffering and its cure, become accessible through silent practice. So, how does speech and silence play a role in the unfolding of the Exodus story? The descendants of Jacob who went down into Egypt were fertile and prolific, so that the land was swarming with them. And the new king of Egypt ordered the killing of firstborn males, lest these immigrants outnumber the Egyptians. Moses, at the age of 3 months, was put into a little ark and placed at the shore of the Nile under the watchful eye of his sister, in the hope of preventing his death under Pharaoh's order. Pharaoh's daughter sees the little ark and opens it, and there is a little boy crying. This is the first utterance we hear from Moses. His cry, his communication with the Pharaoh's daughter, is loud and clear. It saves his life. Pharaoh's daughter recognizes this must be a Hebrew child, yet her heart has been moved to disobey her father's order and to make sure the boy lives. As we read this story, it sounds as if Moses's sister Miriam immediately offers then and there to get a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child. However, the Midrash offers an expanded story that Pharaoh's daughter first assigned her own wet nurses to suckle Moses, because, of course, any self-respecting Pharaoh's daughter would have her own wet nurses, as Aviva Zornberg says in telling this midrash. However, Moses would not suckle at the breasts of the Egyptian nurses. And this prompted the princess to accept Miriam's offer of a Hebrew nurse, who turned out to be Moses' mother, to suckle Moses. Aviva Zornberg points out that this midrash highlights early on that there is something special about the mouth of Moses, a mouth that will later be chosen to speak the words of God. We recognize the pivotal role of crying out, as baby Moses does, in the next part of the story. God is about to begin the project of liberating the children of Israel from oppression and leading them to revelation and service to God, communion with God. Only when the children of Israel cry out. After all, God has not intervened for 400 years of oppression in Mitzrayim. Why now is God moved to intervene? God says to Moses at the burning bush, "I have heard the cry of my people. I have seen their affliction. I have known their suffering." Liberation is set in motion only when the people cry out. The powerful communication of crying, which is, after all, a wordless vocalization, sets in motion the journey of liberation and the possibility of communion with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh that is the heart of the Exodus story. Moses embodies a confusing and evolving relationship with speech and silence that is traced through the rest of Torah. Moses, who describes himself as heavy of mouth and heavy of tongue, initially refuses to be chosen to communicate God's message. "Find someone else," he pleads. Exasperated, God assures him his brother Moses, who can speak, is on his way. "You shall speak to him. You shall put the words in his mouth. I myself will be with your mouth and with his mouth and will instruct you both as to what you should do, what you shall do. He shall speak for you to the people. He shall be a mouth for you, and you shall be a God for him." Zornberg highlights the way in which Moses is more comfortable in his moments of communion with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh than in his role as a mouthpiece, speaking to the people. Moses ascends Mount Sinai to receive God's words and stays there for 40 days until God says to him, "Lech Red, get down there, go down there." Zornberg points out that he's being sent away from the place where he feels most comfortable in communion with God. And God is saying, "I don't need you here. Your place is down there with them. I need you in your role speaking to the people for me, that place where you find it most difficult to be." To explain Moses' capacity for wordless communion with God and his difficulty speaking with the people, Zornberg cites a familiar midrash of the Maharal, that's the Hebrew acronym for Moreinu HaRav Lo, our great teacher, Rabbi Lo, a 16th century Bohemian rabbi, philosopher, and mystic, famous as the chief rabbi of Prague. You may have heard of this as a folktale. When a Jewish baby is born into the world, the baby has to leave the purely spiritual reality that the baby inhabits before birth. Some versions of this midrash describe babies as learning all of Torah in utero. As the baby emerges into the world, the angel strikes the baby on the lip and the baby forgets everything. That's why we have this little indentation here. By way of compensation, the strike on the lips opens the baby's mouth so the baby cries at birth and is able to speak later on. So forgetting and speaking go together. You can have infinite wisdom but no ability to communicate with speech, or you can forget everything that you knew that made speech was irrelevant in this purely spiritual abode. And then you have to communicate through speech. The Midrash implies that Moses was never struck on the mouth, and indeed he describes himself as having uncircumcised lips, as if his mouth was never opened. Born into the world, still knowing everything, he does not learn to speak. So when Moses says he is not a man of words, he is revealing that he never got that slap on the mouth that would open his lips. He never lost that capacity for total immersion in the nonverbal oneness with God, where no words were needed. Yet Moses' great task in life is to force himself to keep coming back down into the world, becoming more human, eventually becoming a great leader who leaves us in his final, the final book of Torah, with his spiritual legacy in the form of this great long speech in Devarim, in his own words. This myth might leave us with the impression that spiritual knowledge and language are opposed to each other. You either understand everything and there's no need for words, or you know nothing but you can talk. As Jewish and Buddhist approaches both play with these polarities of speech and silence, we might think that the Jewish tradition is all about learning by studying texts, while the Buddhist practice is all about developing wisdom through silence. However, as we explore these two traditions more deeply, we see how both Jewish and Buddhist practice recognize the limitations of words and also necessarily use words, an important form of human communication, to motivate us, to inspire us to reach beyond the limits of language. And this is also true of poetry, especially modern poetry, music, and many art forms that break through the barriers that we've created through language. Norman Fisher has written and spoken about Kabbalistic and Zen approaches that use language to free us from the bonds of language. Norman notes that the Kabbalists were obsessed with language, but they weren't interested in a logical or intellectual approach to the surface story of the text. Rather, every word of text masked hidden depths that revealed operations crucial to the salvation of the world on a moment-to-moment basis, and every word was related not only to every other word of text, but to everything else throughout the whole of the mundane and supernal realms. This is a quote from one of his talks. Things of the world were, in their essence, things were also words, and in Hebrew, devar means both word and thing. As we know from reading Torah, the original temple practice, it was not, you know, they didn't have a siddur with all the tefillot and all the brachot. They weren't reciting all the things we recite in temple. But the temple practice was the performance of a ritual sacrifice. Now, it must have been noisy with all the animals and all the people, but the Torah gives instructions to the priests only in their actions, the anointing with oil, the dipping in blood. Words later became a substitute for these silent rituals. As such, we might best recite the prayers, not with a focus on the meaning of the words, but on the action of chanting, of rhythmic repetition, the tones and cadences through which we enact the sacred rituals or worship and experience communion with something greater than ourselves. In his essay on silence and language, which is on the Everyday Zen website, it's called Light, Parentheses, Silence, Word. Norman explains, what at first may seem in Zen to be a bias against language in favor of silence and in favor of silent practices like meditation that are not language based is nevertheless in Zen also an emphasis on a view of language and a practice of language. So this is Norman's explanation of the polarities of speech and silence in Zen practice. For example, the koan practice is the practice of studying teachings which cannot be understood through a logical analysis of language. Rather, the words of the koan become the object of silent contemplation. This is not, Norman explains, mindfulness of something, of the words, but mindfulness of the silence, spaciousness, or emptiness that is always at the heart of experience. So a key point in this is that language is another form of experience, just like everything else that arises and passes in our awareness. I found even more accessible Kathy Fisher's explanation in her talk at the most recent Awakened Heart Meditation Retreat. If you go to the Everyday Zen website, it's one of the most recent teachings. She explains, the words we use are like street signs. They are not the streets, but they help us to find the streets. She cautions us not to get too caught up in trying to understand difficult words like emptiness. Words like that, she said, are not the best containers for Buddhist teaching. These words point to human experience, but can't explain it. Human experience is dynamic. It is changing. It is emerging, she explained. It cannot be pinned down. And that is the meaning of emptiness. That, and I'll say in my own words, things that I've heard from the Zen tradition, that human experience is empty of solid and enduring separateness. So that emptiness really carries the message that we all are empty of having a separate, solid, enduring self. Words and language, however, can contain us without our noticing, like living in a beautiful house. This is Kathy Fisher's metaphor, that we live in and then we don't notice what's outdoors. She says we don't need to burn the house down, we just have to walk out the door. And Kathy Fisher goes on to describe how the door is already there, we don't have to build it, it's probably even open, but we walk past it without noticing. This is similar to a Kabbalistic story that I heard, that all you have to do to answer the communication of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is to hear the knock on the door. And then you realize that there is no door that is being knocked on. So, how do we go through the door? Kathy Fisher explains that we walk out of the house by giving language a break in our meditation practice, by allowing thoughts and words to arise and pass and fall away. We learn how to turn our attention to all the other five senses. In Buddhist practice, the sixth sense is thinking. Thoughts are what we perceive with the sense organ of the mind. And the mind tends to dominate and make it harder to perceive the other five senses. So we especially pay attention to the other five senses, direct perceiving of all our other senses through attention to the breathing body as a way of giving language a break, walking through the door. Attunement to these nonverbal ways of connecting with experience through feeling the air on our skin, the sounds we hear, the light we see, the smells and tastes we can never entirely capture in words, but we're intimately familiar with them. And we spend time each day with each sense in our practice as a way of learning how we can live in all of our senses, not just in our minds and in our thoughts.